Welcome to this edition of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. My name is Mike Bolton. We are here in one of the final podcasts for this 018 festival, and we are looking at Queens of the Night. And we are thrilled to be joined by Stephanie Blythe, John Jarbo, and Dito von Reigersberg, who are the stars.
We are the stars of Queens of the Night.
We are the queens.
We are the queens.
We are the queens.
And this is the night.
Yes. And this is our night.
We're doing three shows. Three different shows within a week.
And it's
That's insane.
It's 8:30. We're crammed into a warm, stuffy Opera Philadelphia
it's
office.
It's not that stuffy. I've been in stuffier.
Sky on Swings is having its world premiere at this very second.
Yeah.
We're sending them toy.
And you guys are very generously sitting around just to chat about this phenomenal, funky, crazy, amazing Queens of the Night.
Yes.
Thanks for being here.
We are funky and crazy. And
I was in between performances of Tancredi. My throat was dry, and I desperately needed a pumpkin latte. So I went to the Starbucks down on Broad and Pine, pining away for my latte, digging for change. When I heard the barista call out, cracker, I looked up, and there was Martha.
What brings you back 3 years later? 2 years later?
Two years later.
Well, we didn't have anything else to do. Just kidding. No, we were. It was such a crazy fluke of a success last time.
It was not a fluke.
It wasn't a fluke, but it was amazing. It was a one night only.
Amazingly planned, one night only, spectacular extravaganza.
We make the best one night stands in opera.
We do.
That's
yes.
What we do.
Yeah.
You like one night stands.
We do it.
We've got three of
them. Right now.
That's right.
With
come
some
on
of
down.
The best in opera.
That's right.
Yeah, guest stars.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie Blythe as Blythely. Pat Rosette as Pat Rosette. Brenda Ray is
Brenda Ray.
I mean, Justin Vivian Bond is a goddess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's been exciting about this process? And how is it different from the last time, other than it's longer?
Well, so last time we made a show that it was a duet, really a long...
Yes.
It was almost like edging. a duet in which we were trying... Not to meet each other, we were suspending the moment of us actually coming together for like an hour. So we spent a lot of time sending
total
letters to each other. We speak to each other over a big distance. Then we have to find a way to come together. So that's one show. But then we wanted to make two prequels to the show that we had made originally, mm-hmm. Dito and Aeneas. So we made kind of shows from Blythely's point of view in preparation and Martha's point of view in preparation for their meeting.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
And who is Blythely?
Blythely Oratonio is a world famous dramatic tenor.
And he has come to the TLA to...
And he's come to the TLA because he has found that there is something about Martha Graham Cracker that has revived or awoken in him something that he thought was long gone, and he's awake. He's ready to embrace a part of himself that he didn't realize was still there, and we're going to see part of that journey, and then how that journey is realized.
Is any of that true for Stephanie Blythe?
Absolutely, 100%.
And what has been reawakened?
I think that what has been fascinating for me about this, I mean, I was, you know, when we first talked about Dito and Aeneas, It was after a Mahler 8 performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra, mm-hmm. and both John and Dito had attended that performance. And I had never met Dito. I knew Dito through his family, through his parents, who were my host family when I was a student at Wolf Trap Opera.
No kidding.
And his mother has been like a, well, both of his parents really, but especially his mother, has been like a mother figure to me for a long time. And one of the most delightful things, my own mother, who was ill for a very long time, could not come and see me perform a lot. And Dito's mother, Stephanie, would actually go and see performances and then call my mother and tell her everything that happened and fill her in on how wonderful it was. And so, you know, she's a very, very important fixture in my life. And we all met backstage, and that's how I met John for the very first time. And John had done Andy a Popera with Opera Philadelphia. And we were just standing around talking with David Devan, and I just looked at David and I said, you know, what would you think about, I would love about Martha and me getting together and doing a show to benefit this opera company. And John came up immediately with the idea of Dito and Aeneas. It would absolutely be brilliant. I mean, he came up with a title right then. Mm-hmm. And David looked at us all and said, yeah, we can do that. And almost a year to that day, we did it.
Yeah.
And what was wonderful about it was that, you know, as an opera singer, which I love being an opera singer, I really do. One of the things that I don't get to do a lot of is to explore my creative side as a creator. I'm someone who reimagines or who interprets someone else's ideas. And with this, we work together to be creators together. Now, granted, we use other people's music, but we write together, we improvise together, and John turned something on in me that has, I think, was ready to come out at this point in my life. I met John Jarboe at the very perfect moment of my life, and he's changed me as a performer, full stop, changed me as a performer. And his first real work with me was Tancredi, because I don't think that I would have sung or played that role the same way and as successfully as I did had I not met John and worked with him before that. So it was very, you know, it's been amazing. And being with Dito and with John, with Machine Dazzle, with Dan Kazemi, who was our music director.
It's amazing.
All of these amazing human beings are inspirational in every possible way, as artists, as thinkers, as creators, and as people. And their mission to make art something that is accessible to everyone, that not only is accessible, but that elevates us all, is a beautiful mission, and I'm very glad to join them in that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Dito, for people who don't know who Martha Graham Cracker is, why don't you share a little
who
bit?
Who doesn't know who Martha Graham Cracker is?
I don't know. You never know.
Google her.
Google her.
She's in everyone's pantry.
Of course. No. Who is Martha Graham Cracker is the woman who lives inside of me, I suppose. Or the lady who gets released when I put on false eyelashes. And I think, weirdly, I remember in this conversation that we had backstage after the Mahler that we were both talking about how much we loved playing, you know, sort of the opposite gender, and how that kind of released something in us as people and as performers. And I think that that also is something that we are really capitalizing on in the show as kind of it's sort of a weird vacation from what, and I sort of feel like everyone should have the chance to go and have a day where they play. They are the gender that they're not necessarily accustomed to being. Because I think it really enlightens you in all kinds of ways, or like changes the way you carry yourself in the world, and that changes the way, it just does something very liberating. And I think we both enjoy stepping into those shoes, mm-hmm. high-heeled or not. yeah, and so I really was, well, it was really true that the Mahler performance that I, and a lot of people talk about this when they hear Stephanie sing, that she actually, like, creates a vibration in your body with her voice, which is a kind of spiritual thing, which I just translated to a sort of sexy, also erotic thing, which is not hard for me to do. And I was like, as you know, Martha, as soon as she hears Blithely or Antonio sings, she's like, I have to meet that man and I have to make him mine.
Lord Blithely, feel my temperature rising. Higher, higher, it's burning through to my soul.
How long have you been doing Martha?
13 years at least.
And where did she come from?
She.
Or who inspired her?
My poor mother. Speaking of my mother. No. actually, my father thinks it's my grandmother coming through. But that's another story.
I love that. He never told me that.
Yeah, he's like, he was so worried. He was like, do I really want to see you in drag? And my mom had to like do a scouting mission where she went ahead and she was like, it's actually not so bad. And then he came and he saw me and he was like, oh, it's your grandmother. And I was like, I didn't know. wait, where did she come from? I was in acting school, which is can be a very serious place where you're like, I have to, after the scene where I have to cry or I have to like have this very intense, and you're working on yourself and you're very like self-critical, but at the same time, this was in the 90s, and at the same time I'd go out to drag shows in New York and I was like, oh, this is really like, they're performing and they're not worried about like, do people think this is believable emotion? And they're like we're having a good time, we're, you know, attacking the audience, and we're really quick and witty. And I was like, I think I want to do that. And so I was an actor first, but then there was something I was like, was always like, I need a little kind of like escape valve for all like my most goofy, my most ridiculous, my most campy impulses. And Martha was that.
So yeah. You said having a good time.
Yeah.
So John, how do you organize the good time?
Organize is an interesting.
I don't want to say chaos, but it's, you have all these clearly amazingly creative spirits. You are phenomenally creative, as everybody in Philadelphia knows. How do you make it all work?
I mean, it's really good. It's like a recipe with the best ingredients. It's more Italian cooking than French, I would say. Like it's about the quality of the ingredients and not getting in the way of the ingredients and creating permission for them to be who and what they are. And I think like permission is key, and just to like add on to the drag conversation, like there's a range of genders on stage, and a range of drag on stage, not only like drag into, not only putting on different gendered clothing, but also putting on different musical clothing and different stylistic clothing and trying to honor all the clothing that you're putting on. What I like about and what I'm drawn to about the drag work that Martha does and that Stephanie is doing is that I would call it aspirational drag. It's like you're aspiring to be this idea of something and you fall kind of short and you don't quite know. Like your shoulders are hairy and you're in a beautiful evening gown and maybe your underwear line is showing, you know. And I really love the complexity of how they are both not necessarily putting on something that's different from them, not really mm-hmm. putting on someone else's identity, but putting on a deeper sense of their own identity. So like allowing yourself through clothing, through play, through glitter, and through like singing a Rick Springfield song, when you're coming from a place of opera, to be more of who you are and to like add to the complexity of how we receive you and all the forms that you represent and bring to the stage. So that's what's very rich to me. And organizing. I'm doing my best. It's joyful and just as it's a mix of opera and rock and roll and drag, it's also a mix of all of those different logistical approaches and vocabularies, which is rich and challenging and such an opportunity to get to do. I don't think any other opera company in the world would let me do what I'm doing here. So I'm really grateful.
What I loved about the first one, Dino and Aeneas, was you would get these little itty bitty musical snippets and riffs from this opera aria or that opera aria that came and went and it was gone and then it was there and then so it was this other vocabulary that, you know, if you got it, you got it, but if you didn't, it was okay too. And then you have you belting out Barry Manilow's tunes sounding, you know, more masculine than Barry Manilow. And
which isn't hard.
Right. But it was just such a joyous, fun, exciting night.
It's free.
Yeah.
It's free. And what's lovely about it is that it everyone who's, I mean, the thing about cabaret that's so exciting is that it's a contact sport. You know, in a way that opera is not. Opera is a contact sport in a different way. We connect with our audiences in a different way. And in for the most part in a distant way. The thing that's great about what we do is in opera is that we, by virtue of the size of it, the grandiosity of it, or sometimes not, sometimes the intimacy of it, there's something about it's like trying to explain to somebody the difference between popular music and art song, right? So when people ask me what art song is, I basically always say art song are songs that are written for trained instruments, trained musicians, and trained singers. And that's what it is. I mean, that's basically the difference. It's music that's curated to a very specific voice. It's not something that, you know, that everybody would walk around necessarily singing like a Rick Springfield song. The difference is, in what we do is we don't see the difference between those things. We embrace everything for what it is, and we embrace it for what it wakes up in people, and for how people connect to it. And John, what's beautiful about what especially what we do in Dido and Aeneas, is to really break that constraint and say, you know, we can make opera more like this. We can make opera more of a contact sport. We can look at our audiences and connect with them in that way whenever we can. I mean, you know, obviously when you're singing in a, you know, when I'm singing at the Met, it's very hard to, and nobody wants you to, you know, make sure that fourth wall is up. But I think that when people hear, when people hear voices, no matter what kind of voice it is, we glom onto it because it's natural. It's something that we all have. Doesn't matter if you have a trained voice or not. Doesn't matter if you're a singer or you can't carry a tune. the voice, the actual voice, we all have one. And we connect with it. And there's something about what we do in these pieces that just makes people feel free. It makes them laugh. It makes them feel loved and a part of something. And that's what appeals to me. I have never, ever in my life performed anywhere where I felt the level of love and acceptance in the room that I did when we did Dito Nennius. Never. Just general love and acceptance, joy. No judgment, nothing.
And it brings up all of us of a certain age, and it brings up all of this music, of a certain age or not, that we've grown up with and mm-hmm. have been part of our lives since we were little kids, mm-hmm. No matter who we are or mm-hmm. what age we are. And I think we come to opera older or later in our lives, probably.
Yeah,
most people do. So we don't have that emotional connection to it the same mm-hmm. way that we have to sitting
in
our bedrooms.
It's a more visceral thing. Yeah. It's a more visceral thing. It's a more visceral experience. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, when you... I just remember seeing my first opera and going, what? You know, just not being able to really, my brain couldn't comprehend what I was seeing or hearing. It took a little while for mm-hmm. me to, but doing this kind of work is, it's not better, it's not worse, it's just beautiful, open work. It's lovely, and what Dito says is really true about, you know, there's a part of me that's always blithely. There's a part of me that's always had blithely there. Always. My whole life, you know? If my sister and I played, we're playing, she was Jamie Summers. I was always Steve Austin. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I was always the bionic man.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some, you know?
Yeah.
There's just always been something, and I'm grateful to have a moment like this to actually experience that.
So, do you guys remember maybe the first time that you experienced anything like this through your performances?
You mean that feeling of
transformative
freedom?
Freedom in your...
I mean, certainly through Martha, I think I've found moments of real... More like anything could happen. And that's... Mm-hmm. That's what's really exciting about cabaret, and that's very different than almost any other performance, is that as much planning as you do, and there's a lot of planning, something could happen in the moment, and that is terrifying in one way, mm-hmm. but it's also, if you know something clear about who you are in that moment as a performer, there's such a freedom to being like, I know exactly how I can relate to this thing, even though I don't have any, I had no plan to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to mention this. There's a Picasso quote, which I learned from an acting teacher, but I think it's so true about drag. I had this teacher who said, art is the lie that tells the truth. And I've always felt like, drag is a, I don't know that you call it a lie, but it's an illusion. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, or like a mask. You think of a mask as something that is something you hide behind or is transforms you. But it actually, there's this weird way in which drag reveals something deep. Mm-hmm. Even if it seems very kind of like just a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
The fantasy that comes to life is very it's very revealing and very potently personal, I think.
I hear trust is key in all of this. Trust in yourself, trust in your mm-hmm. colleagues. When do you know that you have that trust? Or do you have to kind of blindly go into it on day one? Or is it an evolutionary?
I feel like John, Stephanie, I think will agree with me, that John is really good at creating an environment in which we're like, we know the rules, there is structure, but there's also freedom and play. And yeah, and I feel like he would set up a lot of improvisations or a lot of mm-hmm. exercises that allowed us to, you know, inch our way towards a clarity about the characters and about how they were going to interact with each other and what they wanted to say about the other. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel like that we owe a lot of that to John in terms of creating an environment where that is possible, you know?
Trust is like a constant, it's an evolution. You're constantly like taking care. It's not like a safe space exists. Like every space is, if you want a dangerous space, you have to like acknowledge that it could be dangerous and like create systems by which you can check in and take care of each other. It's just a very loving group of people. And we know it's loving, because if something not loving enters the space, we're like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
It's very interesting, you know, my first day in the Beard Cave, when we were working on, and which is where Bearded Ladies,
we're in the Beard Cave.
So the Beard Cave is a place that they work, rehearse, and I had never, you know, I've met both of these people once, and we talked a lot on the phone, and the thing that was very interesting was John. The first thing that happened was we had a group phone call, and John said, "All right, we need to talk about." I use the word mission statement. You use a different word for that.
Our values.
Values. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about our values. What do we want to do? What do we want to say with this piece? And we just talked about it. What are the things that are the most important for us to always remember? One of the very first rules that we developed was always honor the art before you send it up. That's like mm-hmm. really important. And we don't just honor the art first, we honor each other. We honor each other. And we do take care of each other. And it was very interesting, the very first time I ever went into the Bear Cave, one of the first improvisatory exercises that John had us do was to walk into the room in our characters and to walk into the character. He would have us walk around the room and go from being Stephanie to being Blithely. And Dan Kazemi was sitting at the piano and he would play music for us to do that. And I mean, it was really odd that I could actually feel this transformation happen. And over the course of our time working together, where we had, you know, we had acting, we did acting improvisations, we did writing improvisations, we did, you know, it created something that made you feel like you were part of the process. And sometimes as a performer, I don't always feel that generosity. And when it happens, it's really amazing. And it's made me very hungry for it. Outside of this process, outside of doing this, and it's really kind of taken over my life, and I'm quite happy about it. Actually, it makes me sort of a big pain in the ass, but I you know, I think that one of the things that's really terrific is that it makes you kind of fearless, and I struggled for a long time in my life with anxiety issues. And being fearless was something that came out of being a performer. I had never experienced what it was like to be this kind of fearless performer. And I used to watch, I had never seen Martha live. I watched Martha on YouTube, and I watched like everything. And what struck me about Martha was that there was this unbelievable generosity, beautiful voice, musical, and hilarious, but generous, mm-hmm. and very loving. And there are people, you know, you can go to cabarets where you can deal with people who are not entirely loving, where, you know, where the fun is all from making people feel kind of horrible and kind of getting people into that state of mind where it's like you're waking up that kind of mob mentality. And this mob mentality is the exact opposite. It's something that completely wakes up generosity in people. And it makes the room feel light.
What are you guys looking forward to with this? Musical numbers that you're looking forward to were in this piece or in this series?
I mean, I kind of agree with you that Steph's first song that's like the Barry Manilow mashup with all the...
With Puccini
yeah. Is just like... I love it. I'm nervous all the way through because I'm like, this is right before I enter. It's amazing.
Yes, but you're...
Really? Are you really nervous?
Yeah.
It's a lot. We're doing a lot very quickly. I don't think... Like, We wrote two completely new shows that are more than cabarets. They're like cabaret/opera/plays. They tell stories and they're... Mm-hmm. You know, there's... I mean, the difference between an opera and a cabaret, I think, is the space for the audience. Mm-hmm. Like in opera, there is space for the audience, but Absolutely. It's very directed, and you got to stay on that train. But in cabaret, it's like a lot more space for the audience. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of space, but everything around it's we're doing a lot really quickly.
Yeah.
So of course we're nervous, and we don't have our scene partner yet, which is the audience.
Mm-hmm.
While we're doing some invited dresses mm-hmm. or some invited things. To get the taste of what that will be like,
the
act does not fully consummate until the audience is all with us.
And that is something I wish all opera singers could experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but the very first moment that we were in the TLA last year, and people just started yelling from the minute we started, from the minute we opened, and you know, the minute we opened about people are yelling and they're reacting. And there's, you know, they're talking, and it's fabulous to have people talking back and to have people screaming because they're enjoying something, and that's their reaction. And I wish that every opera singer could experience that, because we are, sometimes we get a little staid.
Mm.
And I think there's an element of joy there that is so intoxicating.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite remarkable. And there's some, you know, there's a lot of opera, man. There is a lot of opera.
Mm.
It's good.
Yeah. And hearing you say that reminds me, we do a student dress rehearsal program. And students at that final dress for any show are all very honest.
Mm-hmm.
So when the girl kisses the boy, they scream and holler.
That's right.
We did Susanna a couple years ago, and there was the body stocking, and kids went crazy over that. But it's these very honest and visceral
reactions.
And
then when the evil
person
walks out, they'll boo them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is totally natural.
And then you get to opening night, and some of the performers are like, well, I kind of like the student audience better. You know,
because it feels alive, right? Like, you're like, oh, there's something... The partner is there.
Yeah.
And is awake. Let's get to dates. We have three performances.
Yep.
Yes.
They are...
24, 25, 28.
Yes.
All at 8 o'clock. We begin on the 24th with Blithely After Hours. On the 25th at 8 o'clock is Foray Play. And then on the 28th, we culminate with the third show at 8 o'clock, Dido and Aeneas, Two Queens, One Night.
Great. Tickets are available at operaphila.org, or you can call 215-893-5927 to get your tickets. If you've never been to the TLA, if you've never experienced Cabaret, if you've never experienced Martha Graham Cracker or Blithely or Antonio, you have to come see this event.
And wear something fun.
Yeah.
Actually, that's been dictated for staff as
wear
well.
Wear something fun.
Staff is not allowed to wear typical opera attire.
Good.
Good.
I hope you, Michael, I hope you plan on wearing fishnets.
I will buy some on Amazon.
Well done.
But I need to get heels.
Well, that's okay. Oh. I think that there are two people here who could possibly help you with
something
that.
Something
in a 10? Yeah. Oh, I'm a 12, darling.
Yes,
so
you are.
Much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. E l'angelica belga sul cancor dall'amor cancerarsi non potrà il pensiero.